Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Richard Martin here from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Hope you all had a nice weekend. It's very cloudy here and very rainy, just about fireworks time. So it's rather a question of a damp squib today this year, but hopefully in other parts of the country things weren't quite so grim. Well, there's a weekend story that appeared in the Swiss Sunday newspaper Sonntagszeitung, based on a confidential report from Bridgewater Associates, which, as you may know, is one of the world's largest hedge funds. And this is a rough translation from the German, and I must say it's kind of amusing that stories of this magnitude from American sources are reaching us via Europe. Anyway, the title of the story was "The Banking Crisis Will Be Much Worse." And this comes from Westport, USA. The expected losses from the financial crisis will be $1,600 billions of dollars, which in the States is $1.6 trillion. So far, financial institutions have only declared $400 billion. This pessimistic forecast comes from a confidential study by Bridgewater Associates, the second largest hedge fund in the world. "We are facing an avalanche of bad assets," says the study. "The biggest losses have been in the U.S. banks. We have significant doubts that the financial institutions will be able to raise new capital in order to cover the losses," says the report. Well, Bridgewater Associates enjoys a first-class reputation in financial circles, and several central banks are among its customers. So if they declared $400 billion out of $1.6 trillion, that means that on those estimates we're about one quarter of the way through the financial crisis. Not very helpful. Lots of people, by the way, ask me, you know, is this a real depression, and how does this compare with 1929? And I have a very simple answer for people. The crash that is really being felt throughout the system now is much worse than 1929, because it's not just the stock market and Florida real estate that's crashing as in 1929, but now everything is crashing. Stocks, credit markets, the dollar, real estate, employment, the auto industry, manufacturing, real returns on investment, confidence, the banks, the insurance industry, retail trade, retirement hopes, home equity, savings, purchasing power, construction, exports, the airline industry, the trucking industry, high tech, restaurant trade, tourism, and on, where do I stop, you know? The other question, which, by the way, comes up frequently, is whether, in fact, the country is sort of sinking into a Japan-like recession. And my answer is, don't worry about Japan and its recession of the 1990s. The situation is totally different. The Japanese had savings. They had a positive trade balance. They didn't have subprime mortgages, and they certainly didn't owe the rest of the world trillions of dollars. They didn't have 10 million people on the edge of bankruptcy, and they didn't have a $600 million military budget on a war in Iraq to pay for. the situation in America is much worse than it was in Japan. Japan could afford a slump. America most certainly cannot. All right, well, welcome to the show. Again, I'm Richard Martin, and this is Richard Martin's Wake-Up Call. I always encourage you to call in if you have questions. Many people write, but it's obviously much more dynamic and much more fun to have you use your dulcet tones to enunciate your questions over the air. So please do, please call, and the number to call toll-free to directly to us in the studio in New York or to myself in Miami is as follows, 888-873-4643. Once again, 888-873-4643. Now, if you do insist on writing a screed by email, please feel free to do that, too. The email address is as follows, rmartin@gscorporation.com. Two things to remember, the usual two things. The GS stands for Global Strategic Investments being the company where I work, and the word corporation, which needs to be written out in full. Okay, once more, I give you the email address for your correspondence. rmartin@gscorporation.com. Okay, and finally, of course, my own direct line in case you want to ask personal questions or discuss matters in private. This is to be done by calling the following number. 305-357-5575. Let me do that once more. 305-357-5575. Okay, that's my direct line. You can call me anytime, preferably not at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I will be glad to talk to you. Okay. Well, just one thing, please. Ladies and gentlemen, I did make this request of you last week, last Thursday, in fact, which is to say on Monday last, that was the 30th of June, I gave a long, uninterrupted talk about the credit derivative situation, a little bit of history, a little bit of what's going on right now and what to expect in the future. And if you are wondering how to spend your time over the next few days and you have a choice of archives to listen from, please make it the archive from the 30th of June, because I think you'll find that what I say there will unravel a lot of the mystery about these arcane investments, these credit derivatives, and they will also allow you to understand something of the motivations that gripped the operators of these things and why they went completely crazy and why things have come to the pass they have. It is very informative. If you haven't heard it already, I strongly recommend that you listen to it at some point in the next few days. That's the archive from the 30th of June. Okie doke. Well, right. Now, there's a book that came out last year, and I didn't mention it, and I should have, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it today. It's called The Panic of 1907, Lessons Learned from the Market's Perfect Storm. And it's written by Robert Bruner and Sean Carr. And basically, and repeat the title once more, it's called The Panic of 1907, Lessons Learned from the Market's Perfect Storm, a book written by Robert Bruner and Sean Carr. It happens to be a very well-documented step-by-step study of one of the worst bank panics and stock market crashes in modern times. Just for your information, the broad stock market declined 37% from peak to trough in less than 15 months. Not quite a crash according to the day-by-day definition, but certainly in its effect quite as devastating as any crash we've seen before or since. I'm going to quote you, quite extended actually, it's a quote from the author's closing remarks, because I think it gives a flavor of the book, and it's really quite fun. So here goes. Why do markets crash and bank panics occur? Any single case study, such as the one we have presented here, is subject to a range of interpretations, and we encourage the reader to draw one's own conclusions from the foregoing narrative. Yet we think that the story of the panic and crash of 1907 inspires consideration that major financial crises can be the result of a convergence of certain unique forces, the forces of the market's perfect storm, that cause investors and depositors to act with alarm. The recounting of the events of 1907 suggests that the storm gathers as follows. It begins with a highly complex financial system whose very complexity makes it difficult for anyone to know what might be going wrong. By definition, the multiple parts of the financial system are linked, which means that trouble in one institution, city, or region can travel easily and quickly to others. Buoyant growth in the economy makes the financial system more fragile, in part due to the demand for capital, and in part due to the tendency of some institutions to take on more risk than is prudent. Leaders in government and the financial sector implement policies that advertently or inadvertently increase the exposure to risk of crisis. An economic shock hits the financial system. The mood of the market swings from optimism to pessimism, creating a self-reinforcing downward spiral. Collective action by leaders can arrest the spiral, though the speed and effectiveness which they act ultimately determines the length and severity of the crisis. Okay, well, my reaction is pretty similar to that of the authors, except for a little bit of different emphasis here and there and a slightly different slant. But I have read a lot about other panics and crashes, and of course I've been very much involved with the tech wreck of 2000. Well, all panics, or almost all panics and crashes, are preceded by sustained periods of artificial growth, which are not based on improvements in productivity, but by a false expansion in the money system, which is aided and abetted by speculators and financiers. Now, they may not act in overt cooperation, yet there is an unmistakable collusion of purpose that occurs. It suggests to me that the impulse to benefit in this way is present in a portion of the people at all times, as there are impulses to do many other things for personal benefit without regard to the public good, but at certain times the prohibitions which normally hold this behavior in check are just weakened, sometimes through active intervention. Okay, now, secondly, almost all panics and crashes involve relatively small groups of people who seem to be at the heart of the matter, and they are closely interlinked into small cartels of corrupted self-dealing involving the accumulation of enormous personal fortunes. I was struck by the interconnectedness of the primary players in the panic of 1907 in each other's companies, banks, investments, and boards of directors. In this instance, there didn't seem to be any significant corruption of the government, which was actually in a progressive mood under Theodore Roosevelt, although he was by now a lame duck. Rather, the central government of this time was weak, and regulation was largely in the hands of the business principals, of which no greater example than J. Pierpont Morgan. They will always act to protect their own interests when threatened, but their benevolent reputations are greatly exaggerated. Okay, finally, there is always what you might call the overextension of credit and excessive leverage. Always. This is the very essence of how a Ponzi scheme grows. For it's in every case what precedes and precipitates the growth of a crisis and panic. The unreasonable overvaluation and expansion of assets, concentrations provoked again by a relatively small number of men interlinked loosely through business associations. Well, as in the case of 1907 and its aftermath, a few visible persons are offered up for punishment and destruction, but the largest and most substantial of the predators are unscathed, often being lionized as saviors who attempted the rescue of the nation from a few bad apples and the public from its own folly. Well, although the authors make a great deal of the need to take swift and decisive action to stem the crisis, they miss the point that the place to stop this is before the leverage and excess build to the point where almost anything will set the overextended system into crisis and panic. Even if decisive action is taken, it is the greater public that is invariably harmed by the cure, with few becoming even more enriched, although the harm be less than if nothing had been done at all. By the time the crisis is underway, you'll be making deals of convenience and at terms with the devil. It should be stressed that there is no evidence in the correspondence of any of the principals that they desired to cause this panic of 1907 for their own benefit. There doesn't have to be. If a general atmosphere of looting is fostered by the provocations of a few like-minded individuals, their subsequent actions need no coordination other than the insufficient response of society to stop them before they gain momentum in their desires. It is the weakness of the many that provides the stimulus and the coordination. The authors do recount the subsequent meeting of many of the principals at Jekyll Island in 1910 to craft a reform of the banking system to be known as the Federal Reserve System. Well, we all know about that. I'm not going to discuss that here. Let me just repeat the title once more. It's called The Panic of 1907, Lessons Learned from the Market's Perfect Storm. It is a book written by Robert Bruner, B-R-U-N-E-R, and Sean Carr, C-A-R-R. The book was written in 2007. Well worth your time, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, let's do some mail. Very little today, only three pieces. One just came in from Ruth, so I'll deal with that one first. Hi, Richard. Very simple. Do you still recommend treasuries? Ruth. Yes, Ruth, I do. Stay with what is safe, and I will give you ultimate instructions. But basically, those are for people, obviously, who are looking for ultimate security, very conservative placements. Stay with the treasuries for now. Others of you will know what we're doing elsewhere in the markets, how we're able to profit handsomely from the downturn in the market, but that is for people with more hot blood than the average person. So, as I say, if you really want to sleep at night comfortably knowing that all is well, buy yourself the treasuries, the American government treasury issues, either 6 or 9 months. Thank you, Ruth. All right, so I have another comment from Steve Kruger, who writes as follows, and he is talking about reverse mortgages. He said, I have never thought of a reverse mortgage as something I would ever use, as it seems to commit you to live your entire life in one place. This I would find very boring, but that's my opinion. I was giving some thought on this subject, and it seems to me if one took out a reverse mortgage in 2005, you would have the issuing bank stuck big time. You got out at the top, and the bank is paying you top dollar on a quickly depreciating asset. I would think if banks start to fail, your bank would try to get out of your reverse mortgage. At some point, if the bank failed, you might be awarded your title back and get to keep your house. I think we're about a year away from starting to hear about the top dollar reverse mortgage, soon to be mess. Thank you, Steve Kruger. Well, Steve, I think you'll find that the assets of most failed banks are taken over, you know, by somebody, and I'm afraid that that somebody will be rubbing his or her hands with glee as you fall off this mortal coil, ready to present yourself for payback time. But it is true that stranger things have happened in fiction, and you never know, you might get to keep your house. I do think that this will happen from time to time, and I do think that, you know, it's pretty much like, you know, buying a put option on a house. You know, basically, you have the value of the house, and you put the house to the banker, if the banker's still around. So if this is your case, Steve, good luck. Wish you all the best. Then we have an email from Michael Reidinger. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Michael, who says as follows. Richard, tally-ho! I just reviewed the bankruptcy law that was enacted in October 2005. I remember receiving lots of paperwork and policy changes regarding my credit card agreements back then. I was thinking that something must be coming. Here it is. Please share with the listeners the significance, good or bad, of filing for bankruptcy protection. The magic credit card carpet ride weaves throughout this document. Keep up the great work. Dedicated listener, Mike R. Thank you, Mike. I shall endeavor to keep up the good work. Okay, well, in fact, what's happened is that the Debt Slave Act, which is otherwise known as the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, has at long last blown sky high. Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. Let's just review some of the provisions of this bill. Basically, what is important to know here is that lenders asked for and received everything on their wish list as this bill was being drawn up. And the wish list was as follows. One, a strict financial means test that may prohibit many debtors from filing a liquidation bankruptcy under Chapter 7. Two, a requirement that all debtors must receive a briefing from an approved credit counseling agency at least 6 months before they can file their bankruptcy case. Three, a requirement that debtors take an approved class on debt management techniques before they receive their bankruptcy discharge. Four, a provision making it easier for a court to dismiss a bankruptcy case outright or to convert a Chapter 7 case to a Chapter 13 case. And five, a provision permitting a court to impose sanctions on attorneys or even on debtors for filing a Chapter 7 case that is dismissed or converted to a Chapter 13 case. Well, after the fairy godmother, Bush, signed the bill written by industry lobbyists and passed by Congress as reform, banks and lending institutions went on a credit binge of previously unmanageable proportions. The most ridiculous abuse of common sense was the so-called liar loans, more commonly referred to as stated income loans. Well, liar loans are now blowing up. And by the way, liar loans can be discharged in bankruptcy. Debt slavery appears now to be in reversal. I think it's important here to consider a very significant ruling by a bankruptcy judge who recently ruled that stated income HELOC debt was indeed dischargeable. And it's a very big deal, by the way. It will no doubt strike real fear in the hearts of stated income lenders everywhere. The judge in question, Judge Leslie Tchaikovsky, ruled that a national city Helot that had been foreclosed out would be discharged in the debtor's Chapter 7 bankruptcy. That city had argued that the debt should be non-dischargeable because the debtors made material false representations, namely lying about their income, on which Nat City relied when it made the loan. The court agreed that the debtors had in fact lied to the bank, but it held that the bank did not reasonably rely on the misrepresentations. Well, I certainly agree with this. This was an extremely significant ruling, and by the way, it was the correct ruling. But what is interesting to me was some of the comments that I read, which actually defended the lenders. Well, I have zero sympathy for the lenders, and the following are the comments in line with my thinking. Here's one. I argued some time ago that the whole point of stated income lending was to make the borrower the fall guy. The lender could make a dumb loan, knowing perfectly well that it is doing so, while shifting responsibility onto the borrower, who is the one stating the income, and in theory, at least, therefore, liable for the misrepresentation. Well, the big reason this was carried to such an extreme was the Debt Slave Act of 2005, in conjunction with the absurd interest rate policy at the Fed. The Fed's direct sponsorship of ARMS, ARMS, adjustable rate mortgages, and derivatives, and the so-called ownership society of the Bush administration. And the whole lot's blowing up right now in front of our eyes. You know, my feeling would be that the lender would not appeal this because at this point it's not binding precedent on any other court, though it will be cited as persuasive precedent in future disputes. I think the lender wouldn't appeal it because there's a real risk that the higher court could affirm it, and it would then become binding on the entire Ninth Circuit, which encompasses the whole West Coast, plus Arizona and Nevada. The money at risk in this individual case, if there is any at all, is minuscule compared to the risk of this becoming the law in the largest circuit in the country. Well, ladies and gentlemen, binding or not, the die is cast. Under a Democratic Congress and Obama as president, the entire Bankruptcy Reform Act is likely to be rewritten. Well, bankers and lending institutions are now bearing the fruits of their attempts to make debt slaves out of consumers. You know, I salute the ruling of Judge Leslie Tchaikovsky. Okay, right. Well, now, I thought I'd talk in some detail about the parlous state of affairs in the United Kingdom. We hear a lot about what's going on in the States. I thought that I would introduce you to some of the grim things happening in my country, and since they all speak English, the concepts should be fairly simple to follow. In England, as I mentioned this last week in passing, which, by the way, gave me the idea of talking about this, but there has been in England, in Great Britain, an unprecedented 10-year explosion in domestic debt. Nothing like it has ever been seen before. And for somebody like myself who was brought up, you know, by parents from the Depression, with the concept that debt was an absolute no-no, neither a bonder, a borrower or a lender be, and then having left the country and traveled all over the world for some years before arriving in the United States, it's very shocking to me to hear about what's going on over there, because I never would have thought that the people of Great Britain would have allowed themselves to get sucked into this vortex of debt. Just to give you some idea of some of the figures here, the personal household and company debt in Britain has risen to actually extraordinary levels, while public sector borrowing is now approaching the historic highs of the 1980s, if any of you remember how gruesome they were. Total UK personal debt, which includes secured and unsecured secured lending, at the end of May, stood at $1,443 billion. That's our billions rather than the trillions, 1.4 trillion in the States, I think that would be. Which was 8% up on the 12 previous months. And just to give you an idea, every 5 minutes, UK personal debt grows by £1 million, a daily increase of £288 million. That this is unsustainable is evidenced by the rise in court action by creditors against indebted individuals. The number of county court judgments is at a 10-year high. During the first quarter of 2008, mortgage possession claims issued on a seasonally adjusted basis were 16% higher than in the first quarter of 2007. The UK's overall household debt sits at 109% of GDP, the highest of the big five Western European countries and the highest in the G7. Well, what this means is that as a country, we borrow more than we earn. This line was crossed last year when, for the first time, our debt burden exceeded our GDP. In 2007, it took us until the 5th of January 2008 to pay off the debt we had accrued during the year. In 1997, Debt Freedom Day, it fell on the 23rd of August in the same year. This year, it's likely to extend well into 2009. The corporate sector is, if anything, more financially extended than the domestic. Ordinary British non-finance companies have a debt GDP ratio of 123%, the highest among the big five in Western Europe. As Michael Saunders, an economist at Citigroup, remarks, and I quote, there has been an even more eye-popping rise in debt among non-bank financial companies. Aggregate debt for these companies has risen from 68% of GDP 10 years ago to 171% of GDP at the end of the first quarter of 2008. The comparable average for the euro area was only 32% at the end of 2006. Clearly, this cannot last. The debt pyramid has begun to unwind. End of quote. So where is it all going to end? Well, I'm afraid to say that for many, is a very real disaster. You know, and in the same way, many companies are going to face increasing difficulties, and the number of those going into receivership, which is already up 85% in the first quarter of 2008, will rise even more. You know, before this slow-moving consumer car wreck, the government has done absolutely nothing. Indeed, the Bank of England, which is determined to fight the next war with the tactics of the last one, has bizarrely decided that inflation is the primary issue and that it will be able to control international commodity price increases by suppressing domestic demand. The trouble is that if the bank succeeds in restricting domestic spending, it risks plunging Britain into outright economic meltdown. Why is that? Because, as in the United States, the real risk is not inflation, but deflation. And deflation is much worse than inflation, as I've said so many times in this program. In a deflationary economy, prices are constantly falling. If prices fall, profits fall. If profits fall, then growth drops and unemployment rises. This produces a vicious cycle of increasing productive capacity, falling demand, falling prices, layoffs, and negative growth. And this is, in fact, a possible midterm scenario for the UK. Well, the highly respected Bank for International Settlements has already denounced the Anglo-Saxon credit economies and explicitly warned of the dangers of long-term deflation brought about by unpayable debt. Indeed, the Great Depression of 1929 was in part caused by the tightening of monetary policy intended to prick the speculative bubble of the Roaring Twenties. That's what the Roaring Twenties were. They were a period where credit and debt increased exponentially, just as they have done in recent years right now. In the same way, Japan in the 1990s tried to stem a property and asset boom by raising interest rates, which again were too high for too long, and the result has been 18 years of deflationary stagnation. So the credit crunch, allied with the demand to reduce wages and raise interest rates, could tip the UK into a deflationary debt spiral. Quite simply, if the tightening continues, people won't be able to pay their bills. Given the levels of debt that the credit boom of the past 10 years has produced, any widespread default could bring down the entire financial edifice. After all, this is exactly what happened in the United States subprime disaster, when interest rates on the mortgages of low-income households were suddenly jacked up to levels they simply couldn't afford to pay. Britain's own housing sector is now poised on a similar cliff edge. In May, mortgage demand collapsed when approvals fell from 58,000 to 42,000, which is a record decline of 27.6%. As the turmoil of recent weeks shows, the markets are turning against the banks, and the tough monetary stance of the MPC isn't helping. It is becoming difficult for banks to raise fresh capital, and they will be forced to push mortgage rates even higher to increase their loan loss reserves, so driving down demand for home loans and sending house prices tumbling even faster. It is the ultimate vicious cycle. Before long, the banks will be coming back to the markets cap in hand in the usual way, searching for yet more capital. But next time, the markets will say no. Any central banker who believes the current surge in energy costs will become embedded clearly does not understand the way globalization has destroyed the bargaining power of ordinary workers. Wages are not going up, not in the UK, not in the US, or even in Euroland. Last week, the analyst IDS reported a fall in wage settlements even as headline inflation rose. Many workers cannot afford to go on strike and are fearful of losing their homes should they get behind with their payments. There are programs about this every day now on American television, heartbreaking stories of people who are just teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. You all know this. Real incomes are being squeezed hard, and it's happening now in the UK as well as the United States. The retailers are living in the land of hell right now. John Lewis, which is a household name in the United Kingdom, yet reported last week that the sales are running 9% down on last year. Marks and Spencer, or M&S, or Marks and Sparks, as we say, still Britain's leading clothes retailer, even after 40, 50 years, warned on Wednesday of sharply lower sales and profits and promptly saw a quarter of its stock market value wiped out. Taylor Woodrow, the country's largest house building group, also faces an uncertain future, unable to raise the capital it needs and in danger of breaking its agreements with its bankers. In fact, the collapse in the housing market has had an especially baleful impact on spending patterns. The fall in the value of property, which is 7% since the peak last year, with anything up to a 40% fall in prices forecast, which is probably a fraction of what will ultimately be seen. This has been one factor affecting the psychology of households and their ability to take equity out of their homes to spend. The collapse in transactions, down by nearly half, has had an immediate effect. As fewer people move house, so purchases of appliances and furniture are pushed lower. Isn't this a familiar story? Yet, just like in the States with the Federal Reserve, there seems little that the government or the Bank of England can do. After the previous slowdown, which set in after the collapse of the dot-com boom in 2000 and the terror attacks of September the 11th, 2001, the public finances were in robust health. The public spending spree that followed, especially in the National Health Service, helped keep the economy in positive growth territory while many other nations saw their economies shrink. Subdued inflation, helped by a wave of ever cheaper consumer durables from China and cheap labor from Eastern Europe, meant that the Bank of England could keep interest rates relatively low, encouraging the British to borrow and spend. Neither of those benign influences seems likely to materialize in this much more severe slowdown. Well, is the economic story of the past decade played out in reverse? The great imbalances in the economy at last coming to a reckoning. A consumer-led boom fueled by debt a paradise for retailers, is turning into a consumer-led slump driven by the credit crunch, shopping hell. In 1998, oil was at $10 a barrel, and the torrent from the east of low-cost goods had only just begun. Now oil stands at close to $150 a barrel, and with Chinese inflation up to 10%, we can no longer believe in an era of ever lower prices for their exports. So I would say, in conclusion, the UK economy is joining the US economy. And as I said, there is absolutely nothing that either the Fed or the Bank of England can do about it. You know, I spoke last week about peak credit in the U.S., but it is increasingly clear to me that peak credit has hit the U.K. as well. You know, the belief that inflation is some sort of threat is as misguided as it is common. Inflation, as I've said countless times, is properly described as the expansion of money supply and credit, of which there has been none. Credit is going to remain bottled up for a long time as deflationary hurricanes hit both the US and the UK. Retailer hell on High Street, or as you say, Main Street in the US, is just starting. A secular peak in consumption has been reached. The bottom is a long way off in terms of time and pain. And I'm sorry to bring this news to you, ladies and gentlemen, but I think it's much better for you to get this clear in your minds, get this very calmly entered into your psyche, and then you can be creative about how you're going to deal with it. And we will talk about that. I promise you we will talk a lot about how to deal with these problems in the future, and this, it will help me enormously if you call me and let me know where you stand, and if others call in as well with ideas that will help, let this be a public forum on Richard Martin's wake-up call. I think we have a total of 4 lines which can call in simultaneously, and I'm sure I know how to field 4 people who would like to talk, probably all at the same time, but I think we can manage. So please feel free to call in and give me your opinion. Share your ideas with other people. That's why we're here. That's what we're trying to do. We are moving into very grave circumstances indeed, and everybody needs all the information that they can get. My number, the toll-free number again, I will give it to you once more. It is 888-873-4643. Once more. 888-873-4643. All right, well, I just wanted to say another quick word about these speculators, these wicked speculators that are receiving so much bad press right now, especially in the oil market, which is kind of falling as we speak. Really, there is nothing to worry about, you know, except that there is something to worry about, and that is, you know, people interfering in the normal day-to-day run of speculators' activities, which is detrimental to markets in general. In fact, right now there are 10 different bills on the subject in the works in Congress. Before the House of Representatives shut up shop, it approved only but one by a vote of 402-19. You know, even Austria wants the European Union to impose a tax on speculation. Well, after all the things I've said about speculation, really, it's pretty obvious that speculators hold appeal for those looking for a scapegoat. But, you know, there's little evidence to support the criminality or the asocial nature of speculation. For one thing, the surge in investment in oil futures is not that large relative to the global trade in oil. Barclays Capital calculates that index funds, which have especially exercised the politicians because they always bet on rising prices, account for only 12% of the outstanding contracts on NYMEX and have a value equivalent to just 2% of the world's yearly oil consumption. Now, as I've said before, neither index funds nor other speculators ever buy any physical oil. They buy futures and options, which they settle with a cash payment when they fall due. Well, since no oil is ever held back from the market, these bets do not affect the price of oil any more than bets on a football match affect the result. The market for nickel provides actually a good illustration of this. Speculative investment in the nickel market has been growing steadily for over the past year, yet its price has fallen in half. By the same token, the prices of several commodities that are not traded on any exchanges, such as iron ore and rice, have been rising almost as fast as that of oil. You know, does anybody ever listen to these things? You know, the futures market does sometimes signal that prices are likely to rise, which might prompt speculators to hoard oil in anticipation. But then how do you hoard thousands of barrels of oil as a leveraged speculator? Where are you going to put it? And in any case, there is actually no sign of hoarding. In the absence of rising stocks, it's really hard to argue that the oil markets have lost their grip on reality. You know, some claim that oil producers are, in effect, hoarding oil below the ground. But there is also little sign of that, either among companies or countries. All big exporters, except Saudi Arabia, are pumping as fast as they can. You know, ladies and gentlemen, despite their dismal reputation, the oil speculators really do provide a vital service. They help airlines and other big oil consumers to hedge against rising prices and so to reduce risk, a massive boon amidst the economic turmoil. By the same token, they provide oil producers with more predictable future revenues and so allow them to expand more competently and borrow more cheaply. That, in turn, should help to lower the price of oil in the long run. Any attempt to curtail speculation, by contrast, is going to make life harder for firms and oil more expensive. Now, remember what I said before. All speculators must eventually close out their positions. You know, if they were artificial buyers, you know, that would mean that they would drive up the sell price in anticipation of their own sales themselves. But you can't ignore the sum nature of the futures market. If the speculators have to sell, then every sale is offset by every purchase. It is a zero-sum game. It is what we have always described as commodities being a zero-sum game, where the stock market is not. Remember, producers have an interest in selling their output forward to lock in a predictable price. Bona fide hedgers, in the same way, that's people like transportation and industrial companies, have an interest in buying their oil forward so they can plan without concern about future fluctuations. And speculators assist in that very endeavor. That's what they do for a living. They speculate and they provide liquidity to both sides of the physical market. Well, in my view, the problem will emerge very soon, you know, as firstly, economic demand softens further, and secondly, planned production hikes actually emerge. And thirdly, weakening price momentum encourages speculators to close their long positions instead of rolling them forward. I think that what will happen at that point is that net speculative positions will plunge by about 10 to 15% of open interest in the commodities market, and we will see a sudden glut on the market for spot delivery. And I happen to agree with people who believe that the price of oil could be cut in half in a very short period of time, just a few months. You know, people are always talking about holding onto one asset class or another as a long-term diversification, and they give a lot of reasons why this or that factor has permanently changed the investment landscape. But trust me, nothing shakes people out of their so-called long-term investments faster than steeply declining prices. In commodity markets in particular, price trends feed on themselves in both directions. So So we see pronounced cyclicality and much more persistent trends once set in motion than we typically do in the equity and the bond markets. It may be difficult to identify a peak in oil when it occurs, but most likely the fallout from that peak will be spectacular. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Take it or leave it. I hope you believe some of what I say anyway, because, you know, it's really sad to see such grave and profound misunderstanding about such a simple matter as trading. But I guess all price movements have to have a black sheep somewhere, and who better than the speculators? Okay, well, I just wanted perhaps to finish with some rather unpleasant scenarios, as they say, in terms of what happens in the United States as... Oh, we have an email here from Jim Cooper. Richard, I'm reading this out now from Jim. You should somehow get your friend Gary Nowell to listen to your explanation of speculation and futures you did today. He is constantly ranting that speculators should be jailed. Oh, dear. Well, that's not very nice. Jim Cooper, Paramus, New Jersey. Well, sorry to hear that, Jim. You can see the degree of the power of the attitudes that are held about this matter. It's very interesting to see that. I'd be glad to have a chat with Gary if anybody, you know, wants to put him on my show, or if he invites me onto his show, I'd be glad to go to bat with him on that one. Not a problem. Anyway, thank you very much for that, Jim. It was very nice to get your input. Well, I was reading a little bit way back about what's happening in these foreclosed home environments, you know, these ghost towns of foreclosed homes. You're getting squatters now entering through broken windows each night to sleep on moldy beds in abandoned family houses as part of a new generation of the homeless emboldened by America's housing foreclosure crisis. And I quote from real estate broker Mark Charney, a foreclosure specialist in Brockton, Massachusetts, and he says, for squatters, foreclosed homes like this are like a campground with free camping. Apparently, squatting is now on the rise across the United States as foreclosures surge, eviction notices mount, and homes go unsold for months, complicating the worst United States housing slump in a quarter of a century and forcing real estate brokers to enlist the help of law enforcement and courts to sell empty houses. In some regions, squatting is taking on new twists to include real estate scams in which thieves rent out abandoned homes they don't own. Others involve professional squatters who move from one abandoned home to another, posing as tenants who seek cash from banks as a condition to leave the premises, a process known by real estate brokers as cash for key. And I quote for Detective Erin Camphouse of the L.A. Police Department's Real Estate Fraud Unit, quote, there are people who move in and know exactly who to contact and say, if you want this house, why don't you come out here and offer me cash? It's just cheaper for the banks to do that rather than go to the courts. The squatters are getting sophisticated and turning it on these banks who own the properties. This detective, Erin Camphouse, cited another case in which an L.A. man recently leased three abandoned homes to unsuspecting renters through Craigslist, the online classified advertising company. The renters paid first and last month's deposits, moved their belongings in, and lived in the homes for several months. And I quote, in one case, there were loose ends of rehab on the house that needed to be done, and the crook wasn't coming through or wasn't completing it. So they offered to do it instead of paying rent. They put down tiles and carpet and all that kind of stuff, and it wasn't until the sheriff put the lockout notice on the door that they realized something was wrong. Well, this is going to get worse. You know, it really worse. I mean, obviously, this is the prelude to civil unrest, I believe. which I think will be the worst aspect of this depression, much worse, I think, than the depression of the 30s, because people are going to be coming down from a much higher level of living than they were in those days. And I do believe that this will bring with it absolutely unparalleled misery and resentment and anger directed at, you know, the ever-widening gap between the rich and the poor. Again, ladies and gentlemen, something we need to be aware of, we need to talk, we need to face openly rather than sort of hide it, and then we're more likely to be able to deal with it. But I will be on the lookout for interesting things to say about this, and when I come up with stuff, I will bring it to your attention. In the meantime, as I say, if you can offer any interesting insights, don't hesitate to call me, please, or send an email, as you wish. And at that point, we will discuss it and deal with it. And hopefully come to some kind of creative conclusions. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin, once again, wishing you a very successful week. Hopefully all is well on the home front. I will be back again on Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, in the usual way, with another edition of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. So till then, take care. Bye-bye for now.